Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
Hello. Hello.
Given that you're a neuroscientist and we're going to be talking about brains, we've scoured the site all morning looking for the best and brightest examples of brains the site has to offer. And I can only apologise. I can only apologise the tent isn't bigger and we can't get even more brainy people in, but the ones we've got look absolutely filthy. Hannah, actually, we didn't talk about this bit, but you're a neuroscientist based at Cambridge University. Mm-hmm. You also present TV programmes. You've just done the Family Brain Game with Dara Breen. You're a writer. What else would you like people to know you as? How about that thing in Nature magazine?
Oh, yes. This was fantastic. So I found out via Twitter world that somebody, an old colleague, an old friend that I was a student with about 10 years ago, actually, got in touch to say, Hannah, you're in Nature magazine, which is an incredible scientific magazine to be in. A magazine that, it's the holy grail for scientists to be published here. And it was listing me as one of the two rising stars in biology at Cambridge University. I know. I was like, whoa. And then even more interestingly, I was there. The other person that was listed was one of my best friends, Roger, who's another neuroscientist. So both of us were there just going, hang on a second. So that was nice.
And this is how much we love you. This is the sort of person we bring to you. Can I also say at this point, I'm sorry that some of you are getting to see Hannah and others of you are getting to see me. And I really can only apologise for that. If someone would blow a whistle at half time, we'll change ends, okay? So let's get into this. Let's start with the most important question of all. How much does Dara Breen get paid for being the face of the Megabus?
He gets paid loads. I didn't get paid very much for that.
Let's talk about you though, because I know you say in the book that you kind of started a lot of this interest through experiences around neuropsychiatry, but actually, the book is beautiful. I really enjoyed reading this. It's so easily written. I'm not a neuroscientist, but I find it very easy to get on with. And you actually start in the book by talking about two important people in your life, your father and your son. So I just wonder if you wanted to say a little bit about where you come from, really, and why these people were so important to you.
Yeah, so... So I started really being interested in biology about 20 years ago, and I did my undergraduate degree looking at molecular pathways and looking at how genes are expressed and proteins are then produced and how that switches on particular pathways that give rise to these different ways that our cells work and interact with each other in our bodies. And I just found something very beautiful about the mechanistic way that you can try and make sense of how our bodies operate by studying cell and molecular biology. Now, I find myself as a mother of a 3.5-year-old little boy called Max. I was starting to write this book on the science of fate, and my intervening years of studies had been looking more at brain and behaviour and how there's similarities between our brains and how there's genes that are there and proteins and nerve cells that are being constructed into neural circuits and pathways within our mind that actually give rise to the way that we process information from the world around us, make sense of that information, and how then that gives rise to all of our complex behaviours and our habits and also our life stories, in essence. And each of us has this very individual cartography of the mind. We each of us have a very unique kind of set of connections within our brains. So our brains are composed of about 86 billion nerve cells, and each one of those nerve cells is connected to about 10,000 other nerve cells. So we've got about 100 trillion connections within our mind. And that that set of connections, that connectome, as it's called, is very different from person to person. There's no single person on this planet that has a matching, an identical connectome. And it's this breadth, this complexity within our brains that allows us to have such breadth of behaviour that we can each exhibit. And so I found that... I'm trying to understand that, something that I really wanted to do. I found it very compelling for a number of reasons, which we'll probably kind of get into in a little bit later. But so I was starting to write my book, The Science of Fate, looking very mechanistically at how our brain operates, how it gives rise to our decisions and choices in lives. And then at the same time, and as my other role, not as a neuroscientist, but as my other everyday role as a mother of my child, I was also being faced with this decision I had to make. So my dad went to his GPs as a part of a routine checkup, which I think people that are 65 or older...
I wouldn't know.
...have to go for. And he was offered this test, this just standard kind of blood screening test, which measured his iron levels in his blood. And what they discovered was that his iron levels were something like 1,000 times what they should be, and that he actually had this inherited condition called chromatosis, which means that his body was just accumulating more and more and more iron in his blood, and it was actually getting into his organs and causing some quite severe problems for him. And so over the last 2 years, he's actually been undergoing weekly bloodletting, where they actually take out a pint of blood each week in order to decrease the iron levels. And now, thankfully, they've gotten back. They've returned to something more like 1,000 times what they should be, rather than 1,000 times.
But you said this is an inherited condition.
Exactly. So this is an inherited condition. And so the GP was saying, you might want to talk to your family and find out whether they want to be tested for whether they are also carriers or whether they're going to exhibit this chromatosis later on in life. In much the same way as if a mother might have breast cancer and might be carrying the BRCA1 or BRCA2 genes, maybe her family members would also want to get tested as well to find out what the future might hold in store for them. And so at the same time as writing this book on the science of fate, I was... having to think about whether I should go and get tested for a chromatosis. And it, in the grand scheme of things, it seems like a really simple decision. You go and you give a little bit of blood, and then you find out whether you're more likely to get chromatosis later on in life. And if so, you just decrease your iron consumption. You make sure you don't have too much spinach, for example, or black pudding. I love black pudding. And maybe even red wine. There's quite a lot of iron in red wine,
now,
for example.
It's getting serious.
Now it's getting serious. Yeah. So, you know, it's quite a simple decision to make. And yet I found myself... kind of putting off going to the GPs to go and get this test. My son at the time was just a year and a half, and I was already feeling quite overwhelmed with all of the different decisions that I had to make as a parent for this young child. You know, would this be an extra responsibility that I'd have to consider, or maybe actually it would be empowering to have that information? And obviously in the end I did go and get the test, but I found it really interesting to start thinking about how there's so many, you know, from the face of it, writing The Science of Fate, of course we should all know what dangers we might harbour within us, and so we can start acting responsibly and kind of looking after ourselves and our friends a little bit with more information at hand. But actually, when it comes down to it, there's quite a lot of things that you've got to start to consider, and it's quite difficult decisions to make.
And one of the things that interested me reading the book is that I think at a number of points, your personal experience and the effect these things have on you directly kind of don't exactly clash with, but they meld with and they complement, but they also in some ways hold a bit of tension with some of the things that you know as a scientist. And we will talk a bit more about that in a bit. But the main contention of the book is basically... Well, look, I think you take until the chapter on belief before you come clean. Mm-hmm. And you basically say, there is no such thing as free will.
Yeah. So going back to the chromatosis, when you think about what was being offered for my son there... Would I want to have also looked at other indicators that were hiding within his blood and within some of the some of the signals there to find out whether he also might have a propensity to certain other conditions, like, for example, autism or schizophrenia, or how intelligent he might be later on in life, how long he might live, whether he might have resilience to mental health conditions, or whether he might be more likely to suffer from depression or bipolar, for example. All of these things we're increasingly finding because of we're living in this era of the brain where there's all these new technologies that are allowing us to peer into the mind as never before. So scientists are now able to look at conscious moving mammals as they go about their everyday business and watch the connections that I was talking about earlier change within their brain, and watch the electricity kind of fizz around the across the circuit board, this connectome of your mind. And you can watch as animals are making different decisions in their life and trace how those decisions and those choices are being made. And increasingly what we're seeing and what we're finding as neuroscientists is that there seems to be quite a lot of our behaviours, from the everyday simple choices, such as, for example, what we choose to eat, to the more complex, higher cognitive kind of decisions in our life, for example, our career choices, or even our temperaments and our personality that might be laid down, how they might be pre-wired. And at the same time, there's been this genomics revolution, which means that we can now start to sequence the 3.2 billion base pairs that are individual to each of us, the DNA within our cells. We can start to sequence all of that.
Just say that again very slowly, because to me it sounded like we can spot 3.25 million base players.
The base player, not the base players, the base pairs of nucleotides.
That is a lot more base players than any country needs.
That would be wonderful if we had lots of base players within our bodies, just kind of making some nice music there.
But is the thrust of this that increasingly you find yourself thinking that actually we imagine we're making choices, but we're not?
Yeah, So when you look, so going back to the connectome, when you look at there's been these amazing researchers based at King's College London that are working as part of a consortium with scientists across Europe, and they've developed this new technology which allows them to image a baby in the womb, 20 weeks gestation, so just 20 weeks old, and you can start to see these neural circuits being laid down in this baby's brain, and they can actually image through all the amniotic fluid, and they can correct for all the movements that the baby is making there, and they can get these wonderfully detailed images of this neural circuitry being laid down in the baby, and they're making all of their data open source and available. And when I last spoke to them, they'd imaged, I think it was 330 pregnant mothers and the children inside them. And what they were finding was that there's little signatures or fingerprints, if you like, within that neural circuitry, which seems to indicate what the child might have a sensitivity to later on in life. Now, they're based in the neonatal unit at King's College London, the St. Thomas Hospital, I think it's called. And so their primary focus is looking at babies that are born preterm to find out whether they might have any medical conditions later on in life. So that's their primary focus, is looking at medical diagnosis. And what they found is that there's signatures within that neural circuitry that seems to indicate whether those babies are going to develop autism, for example, or even schizophrenia or psychosis. So even complex conditions where the symptoms might not emerge for another 20 years, another two decades, they're seeing that there's this underpinning there. Now, this perhaps isn't surprising, because as I was saying, there's this genomics revolution that's enabling us to sequence these 3.2 billion base players within each of our cells. What that genomics information is also telling us is that there's this high hereditary or genetic basis to really complex behaviours as well.
But actually, this has got very significant everyday impact. So we were talking just before we started with Michael, who introduced us, and someone came and offered him an ice cream, which he refused. And you pointed out that that wasn't his choice, that that was what he was programmed to do.
Yeah, so Michael... Hi, Michael. Everyone's going to now know that he's not that fussed about sweet, sugary things, and he prefers much saltier, kind of cheese, for example, savoury things, maybe with a high fat content, but a bit saltier. Red wine.
Yeah.
If anyone wants to buy a red wine, then he will happily accept that, but not an ice cream.
He gave an alternative explanation, which was that he was severely damaged as a young person working on an ice cream van, providing hyper children with sugar and butter fat daily. So, you know, this is a roundabout way of saying this discussion about nature, mm-hmm. what we're born with, and nurture, what develops. Well, okay, so I went to Warwick University in the early 80s. My tutor was Gina Rippon, who you interviewed in your Radio 4 documentary. I was the first person accepted on the course there, aged eight, I have to point out. And, you know, at that point, they were saying, look, actually, the state of the art is, yeah, it's maybe 50% nature, 50% nurture. And actually, how much further on than that are we 40 years later? Because it seems to me you can't, well, in the book, you do own up to the fact that actually early developmental experiences do seem to matter as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And it very much depends on what type of behaviour we're talking about. In the case of our weight, how much we might weigh, it seems as though as much as 70% of that might be due to a genetic basis.
No, 70% is due to red wine.
And whether you particularly have a nucleus accumbens with a dopamine receptor subtype, yeah. that seems to be particularly motivated and derive lots of pleasure from red wine in particular. So the genes that you were given from your mum and dad, the different alleles that you were given, are kind of mixing together to give rise to these different genes, which then go and direct how that neural circuit is built as you're a baby in the womb. And there's different things that can... And so that's the kind of the code, the instruction manual, if you like. But then there is scope for plasticity. There is scope for change. Not everything is kind of laid down by that 20-week period. And you know, we're not these kind of... We don't emerge into the world as little robots that can't change, we can't learn new things. Of course we can. And that's actually the basis for consciousness. It's our ability to form a subjective view of the world. It's our ability to have this scope for flexibility and plasticity within our brain so that we can learn from our environment and remember new things and then start to react to situations based on what we've learnt before.
But if I've understood your case right, it's that actually we are predisposed to being more or less able in different arenas. So you talk about the black cab study where black cabbies in London have got a bigger developed hippocampus. And of course, what we don't see are all the people who fail the knowledge who may not have the ability to develop the growth in the hippocampus. Is that right?
Yeah, precisely. So just going back to the discussion on food preference, there's scope for plasticity there and change. So when Michael was a baby in his mother's womb, the genes from his mum and dad were kind of interacting and laying down his neural circuitry within the womb. But then also what the mum was eating would also have an effect because the chemicals would also send a signal through the amniotic fluid, which would affect Michael's brain development. And there's been some wonderful studies by Professor Marion Hetherington, who's based at Leeds University, who's been looking at this, looking at whether a mother, if she eats... This is such a middle-class kind of experiment that she did.
And but we're she looked, so not middle-class here.
She looked at... She looked at mothers that were eating hummus, obviously...
So, which was this Waitrose hummus?
She didn't specify the supermarket there. But some of the hummus, and this gets even better, some of the hummus had been flavoured with caraway seeds. And basically, if Michael had been in...
Michael.
You keep confusing him with Richard for some reason. I'm not quite sure. Sorry. If Michael had been in the womb whilst his mother was eating hummus with caraway seeds, then he would start to associate that wonderful warm environment in the womb with caraway seeds and hummus. And then as a baby, he would start rolling towards... Even, you know, just as a few hours old, he'd start rolling towards the smell of caraway seeds hummus. And later on as a child and then as an adult, he would automatically... actually kind of move towards it, because his neural circuitry was wired such that his nucleus accumbens, this region that's involved in motivation and reward and pleasure that lights up also with red wine, possibly, would also associate with this hypothalamus, which is kind of implicated in kind of how our appetites are shaped. And he would just feel this association of warmth and pleasure from caraway seeds and hummus. But there's lots of lovely examples like that, that show that you can change the food preferences during these very early experiences, but that they are largely and up to 70% shaped by the genes that you are dealt from your mum and dad.
You haven't been to Greenbelt before. You may not know, but Greenbelt started back in the mists of time by a group of evangelical Christians who liked rock music. So there is a very deep kind of rooting in not just faith at Greenbelt, but also in evangelical Christian traditions, which is significantly predicated on the idea that an individual can choose to follow God or not. Now, I know when we talked, you said theology isn't your area of expertise, and nor is it mine. Mm-hmm. But again, there's a long-standing debate within Orthodox mainstream Christianity about the notion of predestination, which goes back way before the Reformation, but whether people are called by God, as in the tribe of Israel, or whether people choose God, as in a Damascene conversion, St. Paul. And this continues today, because the Anglican Church has a very significant underpinning structure of covenant theology, which allows children to be baptized at birth, pretty much, whereas adult baptism is practiced by Baptists, who say, no, you have to be old enough to make your own adult choice. It does sound like you're saying that it's quite possible no one here has actually chosen to follow Christ, that this may just be what they were born with.
There is a chapter within the book that looks at beliefs and how beliefs are formed within the brain. And a lot of that goes back to how our perception of the world is formed. So if you imagine that each one of us has a slightly skewed perception or sense of reality about the world, and it's largely based on our previous experiences and how our brain is pre-wired.
I should note, Hannah, to some of us, just the idea that our perception is in any way skewed just shows how wrong you are. But that's a really important starting place to understand that other people do see the world slightly differently to us.
And there's a very good biological reason for that. So your brain uses about 20% of your daily energy quota, which is a huge amount. It's a huge amount. And your brain is a very energy greedy, hungry beast. And the reason that it needs all this energy is because it's got these 86 billion nerve cells that are firing away using the power of electricity, which is hugely oxygen consumption. It uses a huge amount of energy and oxygen in order to do this. And so your body is there kind of almost serving your brain so that you can process all the information that's coming in through your senses, through your sense, your sight, your hearing, your sense of taste, your sense of balance, your sense of touch, trying to process all of these incoming signals. And obviously, it's being bombarded all the time by all these signals that are coming in. So at the moment, as you're probably, hopefully, trying to concentrate on what we're saying and what we're talking about and trying to fit it into your existing framework of knowledge, you're probably filtering out as much as you can how sweaty your bottom is on your seat, because and you're not thinking about that sensation, you're just ignoring that sensation.
We are now.
Now you are thinking, now that I've changed your attention and your focus to it. But there's all of these signals from the outside world that your brain just starts to ignore. And it does this by making assumptions based on our past experiences. And I did have some audio kind of illusions that could illustrate this point. And if you listen to my audio book, then you can listen to them. But basically, our sense of reality is very much shaped on how we process information and which bits of information we ignore and which bits we prioritize, which is based on our previous experiences. And if you think about the fact that each of us has a very unique set of previous experiences and previous environments that we've been in, we each ignore certain aspects and try and fit in what we hear and what we see into our existing framework of the world, because that's less cognitively and energy-wise costly for our brains. So we almost try to ignore any information that might be coming in from the outside world that would cause us to change our belief about the world around us. So each of us has this slightly skewed version of reality that's based on our past experiences and passed on our genes that were given to us that kind of dictated how our brains were wired together in the first place. But then there's this one, and this perception of the world also helps us to predict what's going to happen in the future. And in some ways, that's what a belief is. A belief about the world is our brain's ability to make some kind of prediction, some kind of idea of what's, and to help prepare us for what's going to happen in the future. There's different mechanisms within our brains that help us to try and protect ourselves and also to get us to a more accurate depiction of reality. And religion is one way that I think our brains have been wired for us to move towards this idea of having some spiritual ideology. So, for example, each of us within our brains, we have, to a larger degree or to a smaller degree, we are wired to be sociable. We are wired to enjoy exploring new places, meeting new people, and discussing different ideas with each other. And that helps us to, as we exchange our ideas, our perceptions about the world, that helps us, each of us, to form a more accurate version of reality. And there's been some wonderful scientific studies that subjectively and objectively study this and find out that if we do indeed discuss our ideas with each other, then we are much more likely to arrive at a more accurate representation of the world and so therefore make better decisions. And if you think about the way that majority of religions have been set up, they also really bury deep into our nucleus accumbens, this yes. reward pleasure area of the brain. Not only do they offer you a sense of community, a sense of support within your tribe, a sense of the way by which you can exchange ideas without being judged, but they also have, you know, quite often they have glorious architecture to accompany that, so that you're visually being stimulated and deriving quite a lot of pleasure from that.
Again, I do have to say though that this will come as great news to many people here that on a Sunday morning they're going along to have their reward pleasure centres activated.
Yeah. Oh, it's off time. Right. Sorry, you've got a really sweaty seat there. Sorry.
You know nothing.
And then, hello. This is nice.
They're nicer. Look, we could talk about this for ages because...
can I go back to this? Is something really that I really yeah. believe in as well. Also, there's at the moment, there's quite a lot of talk in the press about us living in a loneliness epidemic where each of us feels slightly disconnected. And anything that offers us the ability to do synchronized activity, whether it's kind of synchronized exercise, like taking part in a marathon together, joint running kind of activities, or rowing, or whether we're singing.
Horizontal jogging.
Horizontal jogging, or whether we're singing with each other, it releases huge amounts of beta endorphins and also this dopamine release within the nucleus accumbens, which keeps us really happy. And it helps us to, this type of activity actually helps us to. Okay, so if you imagine that your brain is taking in information from the world outside all the time and then converting it into electrical signals and then trying to process all these electrical signals at the same time, then actually what your brain isn't doing is it isn't taking in all the information as a continuous stream. Actually what it's doing is it's taking snapshots of information before the next nerve cell can fire, because it takes a time for the electric signal to go from one end of the nerve cell to another, and you can only send one signal at a time. So it's taking this information as snapshots, and then your brain brings all this information together into this continuous stream so that you see the world as this video rather than as different stills. Now, if you take part in synchronous activities with each other, and if you look people in the eye, and if you sing with each other in particular, then what's that what that's doing is actually synchronizing the electrical oscillations across the brain between the different individuals. So you are literally taking in the same information from the outside world at the same time. So that can really help with making people feel like they're seeing the world in the same way, because they're literally starting to.
And as you know from the conversations we've had, I'm desperately keen to persuade you that all of these things fit very well with the group analytic model, and this is partly why we sit in a circle. So you do look at everyone in the eye. But rather than group analysis, I know another area you really did want to talk about was the ethics attached to some of this development and knowledge. And I mean, it's quite casual the way at the start you said, and you say this clearly in the book, basically, if we look carefully enough in the right ways at these brain scans of these fetuses, which is just extraordinary, the idea you can MRI a fetus is just mind-blowing, literally, mm-hmm. we can probably tell which of them is going to be financially successful, academically successful, how sociable they're going to be, as well as these sort of slightly harder areas of having particular areas of hereditary disease. Mm. And the ability to do that throws up huge ethical questions.
Yeah, absolutely. And which that's really the main reason for why I wanted to start writing this book. So in the last year and a half, there's been the development of new technologies, which mean that even if you're just 8 weeks pregnant, you can take a sample of the mother's blood, and then within that blood, you can find some circulating fetal blood so that you can start DNA sequencing the baby.
Okay, so just even baby. Blood sampling.
Yeah, that just at 8 weeks. And then you can get a lot of information, obviously, from that baby's DNA. At the same time, there's lots of IVF kind of companies, particularly in America, that have taken all of this information looking at the genetic basis of intelligence, for example. And I have to say that all of this information is... So we're just finding out all of this information at the moment. There's been big studies looking at hundreds of thousands of people. And in fact, the NHS have been investing heavily in this, in the 100,000 Genome Project, looking at genetic basis, for example, things like anorexia, schizophrenia, but also on the other side, you know, resilience to mental ill health, physical health, and also longevity, socioeconomic status, and intelligence. For example, and there's already companies within America that are taking these preliminary results and offering couples that are opting to go down the IVF route to then selectively implant the embryos that they say, using these very preliminary scientific results, are less likely to go on to develop autism in the future and are much more likely to be intelligent, for example, and have a higher earning potential.
And as a simple person, Hannah, explain why you think there might be a problem with that.
To start with,
do we not all want perfect blue-eyed blonde children?
Yeah, really? I mean, this idea of eugenics has had this really controversial history, and quite rightly, people are very concerned about it. And really, as a society, I think we have to start asking whether we want to celebrate the breadth of neurodiversity, the breadth that our staggeringly beautiful, mesmerizing brains can offer with these amazing circuit boards that we each have this individual, unique cartography for. Whether we want to say that actually that gives our species strength. If you look at the case of Greta, for example, with her possible diagnosis of autism, you know, actually she's pioneering this movement. She sees things in this very black and white situation for climate, and she's acting on it very pragmatically. And if you look, I mean, even at the example of bees in a colony, for example, there are some bees within a colony that will carry a particular genetic alteration within their bee genome, which means that they are less likely to, when a calamity like the queen, for example, dies, or if an intruder comes in, they are much less likely to react in and get caught up in emotional contagion, and instead they will act much more pragmatically and just practically try and sort the problem out. Now, the genes that these bees possess, that genetic alteration, is analogous to the genetic alteration that occurs in those people with autism, for example. And you can see how both situations on particular scales can actually be beneficial to the species.
And we were
talking
a bit earlier about the theory behind group analysis, where our understanding is that you need to think about a group of people as comprising a healthy whole. So you might, as an individual, have a particular deficit, whether that's in the form of a diagnosable psychiatric presentation, like, say, schizophrenia, mm-hmm. or perhaps depression, or just that you're someone who's a bit socially awkward. Although you've got a particular area of need or deficit, actually, the bulk of you is healthy. And when you bring people together, what you get is all the healthy bits and the opportunity to exchange around the areas of deficit. And I think there's something very significant about the notion. And again, in terms of Christian theology, this is a very, very well-practiced idea that actually perhaps we do really need everyone, even the ones we dislike and disagree with, never mind who are particularly different in neurodiverse ways, mm-hmm. for instance.
Yep, exactly.
Look, again, we could stay with ethics for ages, but...
Can I just talk about another technology, which is CRISPR-Cas. I don't know whether you've heard of CRISPR-Cas gene editing technology recently, so some of you have. So there was a scientist in China who has recently actually been expelled from his hosting academic unit for the work that he performed. But he basically got some couples that were undergoing IVF, and he used this gene editing technology. So not only now can we sequence, can we read our genome and try and make predictions about our future as an individual, but also there's this new CRISPR-Cas gene editing technology, which means that we can start to edit up to 10,000, 18,000 even genes at a time in one cell. And what he did was that he did this for the first time across the world. He did this without ethical approval. He started editing some embryos pre-implantation, and he edited them to, he claims, confer HIV resistance to these twin baby girls that were born. Now, interestingly, the genes that he changed also, in some studies in mice, have also conferred an enhanced memory and learning capability. So these baby girls have now been born, and they have been genetically altered. The people that invented the CRISPR-Cas gene editing technique are horrified that this has happened without any ethical approval. And the leader is calling for a worldwide memorandum and discussion about how we start to use this technology or how we don't use this technology. You know, and I think that's really what we all need to start doing, thinking about what do we want our future society to look like? Do we want to be tinkering away and editing things? And if we are going to be editing things, is this only available to those people that can afford it? And what kind of society are we moving towards?
Okay. Look, we've got to keep some time to allow people to join in the conversation with us. Before we do that, can we come back to you a little bit? Because one of the things, we hardly know each other, and I don't mean to be rude, but one of the things that appeared to me reading the book was that you've got really good reason to want to be a biological determinist. You know, it's there in your training as a biologist. You now belong to a tribe of cognitive neuroscientists who are a great tribe to belong to. They all do yoga, go jogging, and, you know, hold exciting jobs and exciting labs, but actually don't really believe in free will. And if you're going to stay part of that tribe, you need to sign up to that. And also in the radio documentary, you said something really interesting to Gina Rippon, when you said, actually, as a mother of a small child, there's something kind of reassuring to maybe think that most of this is already fixed and I can't really, did you say, mess it up too much?
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking, so on the one side, you've got quite a lot of good reasons to have the views that you have, as well as the fact that clearly you were predetermined to have them. But then in the book, you meet someone and you encounter Rowan Williams, who's a very good friend of Greenbelt. Mm-hmm. And the whole book, one of the things you do is you talk about the people that you go to talk to, and they're all really nice people and interesting, but actually the way you write about your meeting with Rowan is a bit different, and I think he sort of threw a little bit of, if not an intellectual spanner into the works, at least an emotional one.
Mm.
Do you want to just say a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I'm very lucky in that Rowan is Master of Magdalen College, which I'm an Outreach Fellow at, and I've got a huge amount of admiration for him and his wife, Jane, who've done phenomenal things. And he very kindly gave me some time to have a conversation with him about free will, in which he actually got quite het up and said, well, I think a lot of science is absolute, complete, and utter bollocks, Hannah. I was like, whoa.
See, we used to have a prophet for an archbishop. Now we have a diplomat.
I think he said, well, what would happen if I said that to you, Hannah? But he said it with quite a lot of emotional force.
Because he's interested in linguistic complexity, isn't he, amongst other things?
Yeah, and he said, you know, so there was some studies in the 1980s by Benjamin Libet that was looking at whether we have free will or whether it's an illusion, and this is the classic kind of experiment. And both Rowan and I actually agreed that really, what does this experiment show? It's reduced this idea of free will down to its very kind of simple thing that actually, what implication does this have in real life? So what Benjamin did is that he measured the electrical activity in the motor cortex, which is a region of the brain that goes from ear to ear, and there's a region of the motor cortex here, which kind of here, about here, which directs movement within your hand. And they also picked up the electrical activity of the muscles in the hand moving, and the volunteers were looking at a clock. So the volunteers were saying what time they were deciding that they wanted to move their hand. And what came first was the electrical activity in the brain initiating the direction of movement, and then there was the conscious awareness of, oh, I'm going to decide to move my hand, after the brain had actually decided to do it, and then lastly came the movement of the hand. And that experiment has been repeated and refined many times, and it seems to indicate that the free will is largely illusion.
Roughly,
and
what it means is the hands were moving before people had decided to. That's the sort of idea.
No, the brain was instructing the hand to move before the person had thought that they were deciding to move. So the brain
was in charge.
The brain was in charge more than your conscious awareness and your decision making.
You know, that happens so much with my hands. And glasses.
Be careful there. So Rowan and I were talking about this, and then also the more recent kind of looks at the neural circuitry kind of within the baby, and the more recent genomic studies that were coming out. And he basically, and there've also been some studies looking at what happens if you erode a number of people's idea that they have free will. If you just completely shatter this notion that we have any free will, and that we are just these almost robots that are acting in a way that was really largely predetermined, then what happens as a society? And what you see, time and time and time again, when scientists have studied this, is that actually people start to act much more selfishly.
Yes.
They just say, as you know, it's my brain made me do it. I have no responsibility, and so it doesn't really matter. I am just a predetermined robot that is acting as I want to. And so obviously that's not a positive thing. That's not a positive message that I want people to take away from this book. And so what he said was that, and we had this wonderful conversation about actually, you know, he was saying maybe I am predetermined to want to discuss ideas with people, but that is the only way that we can actually alter the world around us in a more positive way, is by sharing our perspective and going back to this idea of how our reality is slightly skewed, and that, you know, we are pre-wired within all of us to move around the world, to navigate our world and to try and exchange ideas and to interact with other people and to show a little bit of compassion as well.
And so, his case is that it's the interaction with other people that creates the change. And what's stunning in the book is, it seems to me, that him saying that to you and you meeting him actually sets off a kind of a change in you.
Maybe that was predetermined.
Including the fact you've decided to get a little bit more involved in the church than you might have done.
Yeah, so actually, a few months after that interview, he christened and confirmed both myself and my son, which was wonderful.
Just astonishing.
Yeah, really lovely. Yeah.
And we had a conversation about some of your reasons for that. And a lot of that was about the nature of the church community and the need, particularly bringing a child up, for more people being involved with each other's lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, I mean, any kind of spiritual belief, I think, you know, it offers this wonderful way of helping people to become part of a community, to share a collective consciousness where we're all striving for something that's much more positive for everybody, and to help support each other, and also hopefully, you know, nurture all the breadth of human behaviours that we can exhibit. So it's got to be a positive thing.
And if you want to see a breadth of human behaviour, Sunday morning, 10:30. Perfect. Absolutely perfect. Look, we're going to open up to some questions in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. Are there particular things, though, some people have different relationships to the things that you're talking about. Are there key things that you'd really hope people might take away to either think about or talk about or hold on to or use for themselves?
I think it's... I think for me, it's been, you know, it could be this really depressing message. And in fact, I did... It was this time last summer that I was... you remember last summer, it was this apocalyptic summer and it just got overwhelmingly hot, actually. And I was writing the last kind of bits of the book. And then the editor called me and said, "Oh, Hannah, you know that we've just done a word count and you're 10,000 words short. You've got to write an extra couple of chapters." And then there's this hot, apocalyptic kind of sun. And I was despairing, actually, for all of us as individuals and our future generations as well. And then I started writing and doing a lot more research on the neuroscience and the science of compassion and how we can start cultivating that. And the Dalai Lama came and gave a plenary talk at the Science Society for Neuroscience annual meeting a while back. So he delivered a talk to over 30,000 neuroscientists that converged across the world who were there listening to what he was saying. And he's been, and this talk actually gave rise to a lot of collaborations looking at how we can start as scientists, because we like as scientists to understand things, because then we can maybe get a grapple on it a little bit more for our minds. The science of compassion. And there's some really lovely things that have come out of the Oxford Handbook of the Science of Compassion. And they're probably things that we all intuitively know. And this is generally true of science. A lot of it is stuff that we all intuitively know, you know? But sometimes it's nice to have some molecular pathway in our mind that helps us to understand what's going on, or to have some brain scan image in our head that helps us to comprehend what's happening, why we're feeling this mix of emotions. For me, it helps me to understand and hopefully to act with more compassion. And there's some ways that you can also help trigger more compassion within yourself and within others. So one of them is practicing a gratitude journal. At the end of each day, I write down three things that I'm grateful for.
And you do know this is part of early church Celtic ritual practice.
Ah, okay. So right, okay. So yeah, you're the ones that have to...
One of my students at Leeds did her doctoral thesis based around gratitude as an aid to solving insomnia. Using exactly this positive psychology model of writing three things down. And then I'm in the Glade on Friday night, and the guy's going, "So in the quietness, just identify seven different kinds of sounds." So I was thinking, I can hear bass, I can hear lead guitar, I can hear... But as we said night prayer, we came to this line, which I've lost the words of it, but was, you know, about, you know, "And at the end of this day, I remember these three things that you have given me, O Lord." So, like you said, a lot of these are things that we've kind of known for a long time. People like you know, you now are explaining to us with force why they work, why they're important.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and there's something quite beautiful about how these things that we intuitively know as a species have been passed across generations,
yes,
using religion or using whatever kind of route, whatever mechanism, to help us as a species to hold compassion for each other and to hopefully hold a productive and positive life.
Okay. Are you happy if we let other beautiful friends join in the conversation?
That'd be
we
wonderful.
Could probably stand up so you can at least look the enemy in the eye. You want to take one over there, Michael?
Thank you very much indeed. You spoke tremendously about how technology and development is furthering research. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how the brain develops in your young child and the young children I teach, and the impact of technology on the development of the brain, that young plastic organ that's just still growing. Because I believe I'm right in saying the brain is the organ that continues to grow after birth. All the others are fully grown?
Yeah, so so it used to be thought that the brain that you were born with was basically, that was the brain that you had throughout life, and so if you did any damage to it, then you, no new nerve cells could be born within that brain, and that's it, that's what you had throughout life. But actually, we've been discovering over the last 20 years that there's quite a few different regions within the brain that neurogenesis occurs, so the birth of new brain cells occurs. And one of the key areas in the brain where that neurogenesis can happen is in the hippocampus, the key area that's involved in learning and memory. And the London cabbies, for example, were exercising their hippocampus as they were navigating their way and learning the routes around London. So I'm going to go off on a little tangent and then I'm going to come back to the main point of your question. So one way that you can ramp up neurogenesis throughout life, so neurogenesis happens even in the 70-year-old brain as much as it can do in the 6-year-old brain, for example. So the way that you can change the way that you think and the way that you can enhance the way that you can learn and remember from the environment is by increasing the number of new nerve cells that are being born in your brain, right? And then allowing those new nerve cells to fully connect and function within your existing connectome, your existing framework in your brain. And by doing exercise, by running around, and particularly the scientists were looking at mice on a treadmill and humans that were running, but this probably holds true for other forms of exercise. So if you exercise, then you can ramp up the level that neurogenesis occurs in your hippocampus. And then if you tie that in with exploring new places and meeting new people, then those new nerve cells will more effectively fully integrate within that circuit board. Now, if you are taking children and they are doing an activity that prevents them from running around and exploring their environment and getting exercise and meeting new people and exploring different perspectives, and instead they're physically sat still for long periods of time,
like in a sermon, for instance.
That's not that long, right? I mean, but if we're talking about, you know, 3 or 4 hours a day where they're sat down, you know, stared at a tablet or a television screen, then that's, you can see sensibly that that's not going to be very good for their hippocampus. Now, saying that, there isn't any general consensus from neuroscientists on the detrimental effects of technology on the brain. And the reason for that is because there haven't been proper studies that have been looking at, well, first of all, there's different types of technology. There's some kind of games on tablets that are really good, you know, that can be very educational and they can help children to kind of count and learn their alphabet, for example. But there's other ways that you can actually exercise their motor skills and also the way that they can socially interact with other children. I have to say, so generally speaking, there is no neuroscientific consensus saying that technology is bad for the developing brain when used in moderation. Okay, so maybe 1 hour a day or so.
Should we take another question?
Yeah. But I personally try and limit Max's interaction with technology. So, yeah.
Okay, another one over here.
Thank you. I do sometimes shout at the radio, and one of the things that makes me shout at the radio is it about nature or nurture? Because I always say, and what about choice? I've got no difficulty with the idea that 95% of what we think of as free will is actually determined, but I want that 5%. And this all kind of ties in with irrational decision-making and Daniel Kahneman stuff and so on. But I think that choice issue is, I mean, without it, as you say, people start behaving selfishly if you tell them they haven't got it. So it's crucial. To me, I wanted your response to this. I think having limited choice in some ways gives us the greatest level of responsibility for how we use it. And I wondered if you had a thought about that.
So creating an environment where there is much less choice available makes us think much more carefully about the options that are there and deliberate more on what we're doing. Instinctively, that would probably be true. I don't know whether there's any scientific studies that have been done. I haven't looked into that.
I think last question here, Chris.
One more question, Dan. One here and one down here, very quickly.
I work with children with trauma, developmental trauma. Mm-hmm. What's the neuroscience got to say with how we can best support changes to their behaviour that's borne about by the trauma, you know, very, very young?
Actually, this is what first got me interested in neuroscience. I used to work in a psychiatric hospital just down the road at St Andrew's Psychiatric Hospital. And I used to work in the adolescent ward. And I was interested. Quite a lot of the children there had suffered from quite horrific events in their early life. But actually, quite a lot of the staff had as well. And yet the staff were able to go home after their 12, 13-hour shift. And I was interested in why that was. What helps to protect a brain and help it to flourish. And there have been some studies looking at the genetic basis of this. And it seems that some people, you might know maybe these people somewhere in your life, you know, whatever life throws at them, they seem to be able to just, you know, have this huge amount of resilience and positivity, and they'll turn any negative situation into a positive situation. It's a wonderful skill that I wish we could all have a little bit more of. If you look genetically at what's going on, they seem to have this genetic variation that means that they express quite a lot of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF, which helps this neurogenesis process that I was talking about earlier. It helps, it's basically this wonderful factor that he helps to keep these new nerve cells alive and helps them to connect effectively with other nerve cells so that you can start thinking in new positive ways. You don't just get stuck in a negative ruminating loop of behavior or negative ruminating way of thinking about things. So, okay, so if you don't have, if you're not lucky enough to have this, so this is one of the genetic associations that seems to be linked to resilience. If you don't have that high level of BDNF, right, genetically bestowed upon you, then what can you do to help increase your BDNF? Again, things like exercise, for example, helps. It seems to help more BDNF be created. There's Dr. Anna-Laura van Hermelen, who's based at Cambridge University. She's looking at the adolescence resilience and neurobiology within the brain. And what she's been finding recently is something, again, that we probably already intuitively know, is that if we have a wonderful template of positive relationships around us when we're quite young, and that quite young can be all the way up to 12 years old, then we start to see the way that those other people are interacting with us, those relationships, how those relationships are being formed within that group, the dynamics of it, not just the relationships with us, but the relationships between the friends and their friends, and we start to observe that. And then you start to form that as a template for the types of relationships that you're going to have and the healthy relationships that you're going to have later on in life. And so it's basically trying to make sure that you've got lots of positive relationships.
And I think she also says that this is something that's changed easier at a group level than at an individual level.
Yeah.
So again, the collective is important. This needs to be a quick question, I'm afraid.
Right, OK. Hannah, thank you very much. Could I go back to the ice cream and the choice of the ice cream, and also point you to the philosophy of Henri Bergson, a Frenchman? He said that we can't possibly know what choice that person would make until the very moment that they make the choice, because their feelings and their experiences right up to that moment could change the choice. In other words, you have to get right up to the point where all our emotions, all our previous experiences, all our life choices before, all our DNA and everything else, that all comes to that point, and then we make that choice at that point. Now, we can't predict the choice because we don't know what happens just before the choice is made. And if that's true, then the future choices of Michael are not predictable either, because he's going to go through other experiences, he's going to have other feelings, and when he makes other choices, there are all sorts of things that will influence that choice that we can't know about now.
Can I take this? Because I know about cricket and you don't.
Quite.
So we did all know what was going to happen yesterday in Headingley and Leeds, and it didn't, did it? Look, we're running out of time completely. Actually, there isn't really time to respond to that, but if you're around, maybe you'd be willing to talk. Very briefly, what do you think of Greenbelt?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's beautiful. It's like entering Narnia land, isn't it? It's fantastic. I love it.
And so, are you going to come back?
I'd love to. Yes, please.
Well, I think it's predetermined. Yes. So we'll see you next year. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hannah Critchlow.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.